Hello. Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where one of the hosts does not hand out draft grades because he doesn't have hands and he doesn't know how to write. That's Lenny. So if my voice sounds a little bit tired, creaky, cool is the adjective I would go with. It's because I spent a lot of the last few days screaming. Not a lot, but enough to kill my voice. The draft is finally over. It feels a little bit like the scene at the end of the action movie where everyone is chill. The two cops are playing with their kids because they both survived. And then there's like a hint at the very end for the next fight. I guess that's a more of a comic book movie. I have not seen Avengers Endgame, but I am joined by my colleague who somehow found time during the draft to go see Avengers Endgame. That is Mike Golic Jr. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Mina, thanks for having me. And what you just described is actually one of the first post-credit scenes from the original Avengers movie where the entire gang has just finished saving New York from Loki's army from space, and they celebrate with a very relaxed, you know, triumphant but very tired trip to a shawarma joint that Robert Downey Jr. references Iron Man at the end of the film before the post-credit scene. So you described it perfectly.
You know, I worked at a shawarma joint in college that has a sister shawarma joint in New York called Mamoon's. I don't know if it's still there. It used to be on McDougal Street, but I worked at the one at Yale. And during those years, I ate a lot of baklava because I was in charge of cutting the baklava. Oh. And when you're in charge of cutting the baklava, that means you make a lot of mistakes. So you can eat a lot of the baklava. So that's my shawarma story. Did you like the movie?
Yes, I loved the movie. The difficulty was I saw it with a bunch of our coworkers that were on the production side of the Twitter broadcast of the draft that we were on. And it's really emotional at the end. It's 10 years in the making of the Marvel comic book universe. And I am just openly weeping.
No spoilers.
No spoilers, but obviously super emotional just in general because it's a movie at the end of a 10-year franchise. And we are all weeping, refusing to look left or right because should we do that, we will make eye contact while weeping and thus break down the wall that separates every man within a movie who knows he's crying, knows his friends are crying, but can't share in that experience together.
That's how I felt during the Daniel Jones pick. Didn't want to make eye contact with anyone. So we did 3 days of draft coverage. Ooh. My voice does sound really cool now. I wish I could achieve this vocal sound without screaming or being sick. It sounds so awesome when I'm sick.
But it really is like strange. Do women really covet this like low smoky voice? Is that a thing?
Well, I personally do because I get a lot of negative feedback when I go high, which is the patriarchy probably.
Yes.
I also just think it sounds cool. I like it when women have voices like this. I think it sounds dope. But so we did three. The last day was really, I want to say 5 or 6 hours. Day 3 of the draft is where you're not even pretending to know like the long snapper taken in the 6th round. You're just doing sports radio.
100%. And thankfully we had 3 people and myself, you and Jason Fitz, who were kind of along with that. But it was nice because I feel like the guys on the traditional draft broadcast have to really actually fake it. We just got to kind of punt and be like, yeah, he plays football, apparently.
Good football player. Out of all the 3 days, what was your favorite moment?
My favorite moment, probably in the first day. I mean, honestly, I know it was the one that ended up going viral on the internet and everything like that, but the Daniel Jones pick was what we were all focused on going into day one, and just the collective explosion on our set. Dominique was banging his head on the glass in the background. You and I had shot off like we had just seen a magic trick for the first time in public. It was all just so much happening at once.
Seeing a magic trick for the first time in public is a really odd choice, but somehow makes a ton of sense. Well, you know, okay, so I thought there were rumors that that might happen, and I kind of thought it was Dave Gettleman trolling the media after, you know, taking a lot of criticism over the last couple of years for the Saquon pick, the handling of Eli, that sort of thing, and we all know how he feels about analytics. So I kind of thought it was a troll, and actually, when I had Lewis Riddick on, I talked about the possibility that it might happen. If you love the draft as much as I do, or you just want to watch me melt down on camera when the Giants inevitably take Daniel Jones at number 6, we will be doing a draft show all 3 days from Nashville. So basically, I called it.
Prophetic.
prophetic. So we're going to talk about that, obviously. And I thought maybe for the first half of the show, we would talk a little bit about just the quarterbacks when they were taken, some of the surprise. There were really a lot of surprise. Aside from Kyler Murray, I think everything that happened after that as it pertains to the quarterbacks was pretty surprising. And I include the Josh Rosen trade, which we'll talk about in that group. Then later in the show, I want to talk to you about, it's just some of the winners, some of the teams and people who we thought won the draft. And instead of losers, I'm going to call it perplexing choices. Because I'm not a hater, contrary to what some Giants fans have been saying over the last few days on the internet. Before we get to the quarterbacks, though, Mike, I want to tell you guys to check out The Right Time with Bomani Jones this week. They'll be talking about officiating the playoffs, filmmaker John Singleton's passing. He directed Boys in the Hood. Plus, on Thursday, and this is going to be good, his old producer and the resident Giants fan in his life, Shannon Penn, is going to come on to lament over them selecting Daniel Jones in the draft. There's a great video out there. Did you see that one of Shannon?
I did. I feel so bad for Shannon. Like, every time something bad happens for the Giants, it's just a cut straight to him on whatever radio show he's currently working on. And it's always devastating. And Shannon's a nice dude. Like, I want good things for him, but man, that organization does not.
It's so, well, whatever. I have so much to say about that. I have so much to say about just sort of, Daniel Jones seems like a good dude too. Now everyone's putting out the stories. Oh, he's such a nice guy. I'm sure he's a nice guy. This isn't about him being a nice guy. It's about a team making a decision to take a player at a particular spot, despite the fact that they have X knowledge about that player. We'll get to that. But first, Kyler, it's so funny, Mike, because in any other world, a 5'10" quarterback going first overall would just be such a wild story, and that would have elicited sort of the screaming shock, and not anger, but just shock. But because this has sort of been in the cards for weeks, it wasn't a surprise. It would have been a surprise if he didn't go there. So we've talked a lot about Kyler Murray. I think we both like him. I thought he was unequivocally the number one pick. Some guys thought it was Haskins. Were you with me that he was the top overall quarterback? Before we get to the fit in Arizona and sort of the trade, do you feel that he was the top quarterback in the draft?
Yes, I do. I think the more and more I went back and looked at him, the one thing I kept coming back to with Kyler, and some of this is the Oklahoma offense in general, but so much of what we talked about during the draft was, man, tight ends, deep draft, everything going down the middle of the field right now. And that's something that Kyler was asked to do a lot of at Oklahoma, and that offense does a lot of in general, is creative use of the tight end in the middle of the field. So yes. Baker came in last year and was so unafraid to throw into tight windows in the middle of the field, and you felt like that was really a big part of his early success, was an area of the field where so many young guys seem hesitant to go because a lot of offenses don't push that way and use that position nearly as well. Oklahoma being that quarterback, you come in already with that cachet of just reps at doing that one thing that's become so valuable in the league right now.
Well, that's a really good point. I think the draft says a lot about what they are intending to do with him. I mean, we kind of already knew what they were intending to do for him the moment that they hired Cliff Kingsbury. Whose offense has a lot of the same principles Kyler used in college, right? Four verts, mesh. And they didn't necessarily have the weapons to accomplish that, and they went out and got them for him. What I thought was interesting about the Cardinals draft, Mike, was going into it, I prioritized two needs for the team. One was weapons, undeniably, right? After they have Larry Fitz still, but, he's not quite who he was. And then the second rounder from last year, Christian Kirk, is sort of the other wide receiver. But beyond that, it's pretty thin. And then offensive line. We all know Josh Rosen played behind this revolving door of papier-mâché men last year, and I thought they would go heavy offensive line and heavy wide receiver or tight end. They did one of those things, but not the other. They didn't take an offensive lineman until the very, very, very end of the draft, which I thought was very interesting because they did go out and they got Marcus. We talked about this during our show. They got Marcus Gilbert from the Steelers, the right tackle, in free agency. They signed J.R. Sweezy, the guard, out of Seattle. And then they've got offensive linemen coming back from injury. So there's no way it's going to be as bad as last year. But the fact that Steve Keim went out and signed Andy Isabella with the Rosen pick, right, in the second round, who's this just tiny, super, super, super fast guy. Hakeem Butler, who's gigantic and was a little bit divisive. I liked him better than a lot of people. And then Keyshawn Johnson, who is it's spelled K-E-E-S-E-A-N, which is a statement, right?
Yeah, I appreciate that. As someone who's had to call some games, you spelling it phonetically for me takes a lot of the work out of it.
And like, you know, I'm charting my own path. I'm spelling it differently from Keyshawn. I like that. So anyways, they go out and get all these wide receivers. And what does that say to you, you know, that the fact that they're saying, okay, maybe we're okay with the offensive line, maybe we're not, but we're going to get the ball out. Maybe it says, and I don't mean to answer the question for you, we're going to get the ball out quickly, but what does it say to you that they prioritized wide receivers over everything else in this draft?
I mean, maybe it's some confidence in the fact that, all right, like you said, you're going to get Justin Pugh back from injury. Maybe the pairing of him and Gilbert on the right side, I'm assuming Marcus will play on the right side where he played in Pittsburgh, will already shore up some of that. The offensive lineman you mentioned in the sixth round was Lamont Gilliard, who's one of my favorites in the draft. And I think you can actually get a starter out of your sixth round pick in this. I think he's that good. He's the center out of Georgia. He was a guy that if you go back and look at him playing against Quinnen Williams, who was the third pick in the draft and some would argue the best player in the draft, I mean, gave Quinnen Williams every bit that he could handle in that draft. You know, Mac Wilson, their linebacker as well. So I think he's a guy that's capable. He's strictly a center, so that would have to be his spot, but I think you can get a starter out of him. And just in general, the penchant of air raid offenses in college and kind of what they're designed to do is mask deficiencies of the offensive line.
Yes.
It works best if you have a great offensive line. All those Oregon teams from years ago when it was Chip Kelly and Marcus Mariota and company had very good productive lines, but it can mitigate some of that by getting the ball out quickly, by using the short passing game as a pseudo run game. And Kyler Murray's got the skill set. The one thing I said as we addressed Kyler Murray versus Josh Rosen, as you evaluate prospects and try and decide which quarterback you were going to go with if you're the Cardinals, the one thing I mentioned is, if you are thinking, all right, they're graded about equally as prospects and you can look at all these different things that are similar, is, well, Kyler's going to be able to buy you some time if your offensive line is not great to start with right now. Like, that is one area where we have no ifs, ands, or buts. He's superior to Josh Rosen, and so he can use those gifts. He's a passer first. We know even when he moves, he wants to do that, but having that ability can help you kind of cover up for some of those things in addition to what the offense does on its own.
First, this is why you're on the show. When I say, oh, they didn't take any offensive linemen, you say, actually, this sixth rounder could be a day one starter. That is why Mike Golic Jr. is here on this program. Second, I agree with you about the buying time thing. My only hope is that, that doesn't become a crutch for him. And I don't think it was a crutch in college. Yeah, he bailed a little bit now and then, but most of the time, Kyler Murray was looking to throw, right? And sometimes what we see with dual threat quarterbacks when they come to the NFL, they lean on what God gave them. Now, what we want is for Kyler Murray to have those quick passes, those outs, those checkdowns, so that he doesn't have to do that and he doesn't sort of, his development isn't stalled in that way. So, and I do think Cliff Kingsbury, you know, as much as we question that coaching hire and in some ways, he is perfectly capable of building that kind of offense around him. I will be thrilled to see how he uses Andy Isabella, how he uses David Johnson in the passing game. God willing, free David Johnson. So anyways, you know, we'll talk about what the Cardinals got back for Rosen and the sort of how they mucked that up. But, you know, if you ignore sort of the costs and how they've managed the process right now, it does feel like there's a plan in place that I would be excited about as a Cardinals fan. Now, Giants fans are facing something a little bit different. So let's talk about the mood in our show in the room. The Giants are up at 6. What did you genuinely think they were going to do here? Josh Allen's on the board.
Yes, Josh Allen was on the board. That felt like a no-brainer based on everything, and shame on me for believing what Dave Gettleman says publicly, but that felt like a no-brainer at that spot, right? He was a guy that was mocked top 3 on pretty much everyone's draft board.
I believed it would be Allen because I believe in like logic and I believe these guys are smart most of the time. And I don't know, man. I can't imagine. Well, we saw a lot of videos of Giants fans. Did you see the Joe Budden one too?
Oh my God. The Joe Budden one was as strong as our reaction might have been. Joe Budden certainly set a different tone.
Just like the absolute dejection. It wasn't even like dramatic. There wasn't the flailing of the arms that you got from our show. He just kind of sat down and took it in. And I guess, okay, so we don't have to relitigate everything about Daniel Jones and why.
No, but like you said before, it is hilarious that 6'5" white quarterback, prototypical pocket guy being drafted 6 overall is the shocking news in a draft where 5'10" quarterback drafted number 1 overall also happened. You were right to point that out earlier. That shouldn't be lost on people.
Yeah, when you put it in perspective, it's kind of amazing. I guess, so we've talked a lot about Daniel Jones' podcast. We've talked about his weaknesses. We've talked about what I perceive to be his strengths. You know, his athleticism. I could see him succeeding in a quick game offense, kind of like what he operated at Duke, right? If it was simplified at the jump. I could actually see him too, because of his athleticism, succeeding in play action, which we know Pat Shurmur likes in New York. Although, again, the offensive coordinator is Mike Shula, who does not, that's not his offense. So I don't know what the fit's going to be there. But there's also the possibility, Mike, that Daniel Jones doesn't see the field for years. Afterwards, Gettleman came out and said, hey, it might be 3 years. I mean, is this another Gettleman troll, or do you think there's anything to that?
You know what? I think intent-wise, they would like him to sit for a bit. But as with everything else Dave Gettleman says, you could maybe put stock in the fact that he would start week one at this point based on the track record of public Gettleman statements. But I think personally, the more and more you look at this, him starting the season as the backup would obviously be ideal for a number of reasons. While he's got a lot of gifts, I think we all agree that despite him being a 3-year starter, there are still improvements he needs to make as a quarterback at the NFL level, specifically being able to push the ball downfield, operating on something when the chains aren't, when you're not ahead of the chains, the way you just mentioned. But he's a first-round quarterback in a place where we don't expect the Giants to be all that good this year. And it's hard to ignore those cries. I get that they come publicly, but even within that building, every pro guy we talked about, we had Darius Butler on the set with us, and what did he say? Man, if we have a guy at 6 overall and he's not seeing the field in year one, I'm a veteran. I'm pissed. Like, you're supposed to get return on that 6 overall pick immediately.
Well, the concept of sitting a quarterback, this is like this larger discussion of how long she's at quarterbacks. And again, when we talk about Mahomes and Smith, I think that's skewed by the fact that Alex Smith was still very good. Alex Smith had a great season. He's like, and it's totally possible Mahomes could have come in and been as good as he was later on. I think that there's no way of knowing, right? But you can't disprove a negative. But Alex Smith was much, much better than Eli or Flacco or some of these other quarterbacks who are veterans who are sitting ahead of rookies. The other thing that's insane about the 3-year concept is the reason you draft, not the only reason, but if there's anything we've learned about the NFL over the last few years, the benefit of drafting a rookie quarterback is that you get to spend the money elsewhere, right? You get to, you can take advantage of the fact that, okay, our starting quarterback is very cheap and then we can allocate resources as well. And to waste that window is such a managerial, it's lunacy. Okay. Well, but again, like, if there's anything the Giants have taught us, is that they don't really understand opportunity cost as a concept.
No, that's actually a great point, and one that I hadn't really heard much of outside of this. Is you're right, you kind of forsake, because with that sort of logic, you're saying that not only was Daniel Jones in your mind, and we've heard Dave Gettleman say this over and over again, the best quarterback in this year's draft class, but you perceive him as superior to the quarterbacks in next year's draft class, potentially, right? When you talk about Tua Tagovailoa and Justin Gilbert and these guys that, you know, in theory, you've been scouting ahead, as most places do, and looking what is on the horizon. I mean, how many times last year did we hear about what a vast wasteland this year's quarterback draft class was in comparison to the 2018 one? SpongeBob voice 3 hours later. When you draft 3 in the first round. But you know, in theory, you're saying that, no, we actually value Daniel Jones and getting him there much more than we would value any of the quarterbacks we could have in the future, knowing we plan to sit this guy for a while. So that's kind of an insane wrinkle to this, too.
Yeah. Okay, let me throw out this nightmare scenario, Giants fans, earmuffs, because let's say Daniel Jones doesn't play, Eli sucketh, and the Giants finish, I don't know, whatever, 3-13 or something, and they get a top draft pick. They're not going to take Tua. They're not going to take Justin Herbert. They're not going to take one of those aforementioned quarterbacks, because they're going to cling to the notion that Daniel Jones is the guy, and they're going to waste another year of being in draft position to make the right choice. Like, everything they've done is just, the timing of it is what's so bananas, Mike, right? It's like, they've made all of these decisions at exactly the wrong time based on personnel and talent available. And that's, I think, what's so shocking about
I think that's okay to judge based off that, right? Like, the one thing people keep pointing out, and Dave Gettleman points out, is, well, we'll see how crazy I am in 3 years. He could absolutely prove us all wrong in that time if Daniel Jones goes and balls out. Like, if Daniel Jones were to somehow come in and play freakishly well, we would all look bad, and it would completely render all of those things meaningless. But that doesn't change the fact that where it sits right now, it can still be viewed as a questionable decision in the moment. I always push back on that idea. People say, well, you can't really judge a draft right now. Well, based on where people have guys sitting and the general attitude, yes, you can absolutely judge opinions, the way you allocate resources, the way you forecast future value. That's not a crime. That's what we're here to do.
I know, right? It's like, if you can't judge a draft right now, then you can't judge anything, like, in advance of, like, literally all we're doing is trying to, like, make predictions and judgments based on how we think the future is going to play out. Listen, we'll see. I look forward to being part of a montage of idiots decrying the Jones pick that's played in the 30 for 30. What if I told you that an idiot woman screamed when the Giants took Daniel Jones? I hope I'm not first in the montage. That's all I ask. But I hope Joe Budden edges me out. But okay, a pick we liked, which is also hilarious because it came from a team that we did not, no one, I think, in our draft room, can we call it draft room? Our draft show, expected to like anything they did based on the scuttlebutt we were hearing about owner Daniel Snyder getting medicine. And this was his guy too, which is the only thing that makes me really nervous about the fact that Daniel Snyder wanted him. But, so we're going through the draft. We're getting to Washington. We're all looking at each other like, Dwayne Haskins is still on the board. And then we saw the video, by the way, of him laughing when the Giants picked Daniel Jones. That video is going to go before my video if there's a montage of mocking videos. But anyways, he falls into the Redskins' lap at 15. It was 15, right? What's your first reaction?
My first reaction is the complete opposite. Is, man, for all the talk we heard about Daniel Snyder, who famously traded a king's ransom to go up and get Robert Griffin III at the top of the draft in 2012, being able to have the patience to sit there and say, no, we believe we can get our guy, and you know, you obviously risk losing him at that point, which we know is dangerous if you believe he's your guy, but to get him at a value, we know there was, like you said before, not a consensus about who the top quarterback was in this draft class, if he was one of them. And in a down quarterback class, to be able to get either the 1A or the 1B guy at 15 overall seemed like a coup.
And I really like this fit, even though Jay Gruden reportedly wanted Jones. I mean, who knows if any of that is true, right? We always hear, like, oh, every team in the draft wanted Russell Wilson, you know. Who knows? But even if he wanted him, some of the stuff he came out afterwards and he was talking about the fit with Haskins, and it was heartening because he talked a little bit about, so it's a West Coast offense, which I actually think is well-suited to Haskins' ability, his accuracy and anticipation in the short intermediate areas of the field. He's more inconsistent deep, right? But it also requires some athleticism and mobility on the part of the quarterback, which is kind of one of the knocks on Haskins, right? Is I would say out of the guys all taken in the first round, he's the least mobile. I think that's fair to say. But Gruden addressed that, actually, and talked about how he thought Haskins was actually pretty athletic. I've seen people compare him to Roethlisberger, and I think that's kind of an interesting comp in terms of his ability to kind of move around and throw in the run a little bit when he has to. I think he is maybe the smartest rookie quarterback coming into this, you know, and so he's going to be given an opportunity to compete day one for the job, which is something he's done, I want to say 2 years, right, at Ohio State? He competed for the job. So, I don't know. I expect them to tailor the offense around him, and I expect him to start day one.
Yeah, I know they said that he was going to be given a chance to compete. Obviously, as Jay Gruden mentioned, you don't draft a guy at 15 and not give him a chance to compete for the starting job. That's just not how the game goes unless you are the Giants at number 6 overall. But
shout out Hugh Jackson.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny you say Hugh Jackson because I hear people say the Roethlisberger comp. I see more, especially in light of the Jay Gruden connection here, I see more Andy Dalton as far as physical skill set, where he's not a bad mover and not a bad athlete. Andy Dalton, I was always amazed in the Jay Gruden offense, or might even have been in the Hugh Jackson offense, actually, was used as a read option quarterback in certain very small instances. And I feel like Dwayne's athletic enough to pull the ball every once in a while when the defense has really been suckered in to something like that, can move well enough and throw on the run when it's planned. You know, maybe he's not the greatest scramble guy in the world, but when it came to rolling out, moving the pocket, things like that, Dwayne Haskins tend to do pretty well. He's pretty consistent overall in that regard. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think the fit here is interesting. Obviously, in this draft, we like the fact that as you try and build, you know, continuity and weapons around this guy, certainly there's some already there, but you know, getting Terry McLaurin, his wide receiver from Ohio State, is kind of a cool move in that, and the way that works out is already a natural comfort level for him and one of the guys he'll be throwing to.
Yeah, that's true. We were like, buddies. you know, that I guess if I have a concern about sort of his year one performance, fit, that kind of thing, it would be, you know, they didn't really upgrade at the skill positions that much. I do like the line, which I think will help a lot still relative to some of the other lines rookie quarterbacks have walked behind. But, you know, Josh Doctson, still a lot of question marks behind. Paul Richardson gets hurt a lot. Terry McLaurin is nice, but, you know, there's still some question marks there. And also, because they have to pay Alex Smith, I think, 2 more years, it's going to be hard to get out of it. Maybe the year after next. I don't have his contract in front of me. You don't get the benefit that, again, I was talking about vis-a-vis Daniel Jones, which is when you have a rookie quarterback who's cheap, you get to spend money around him, right? So they're still devoting a lot of money to the position, which isn't ideal. But we like this. We like the pick. And I also loved where Drew Lock landed. And okay, so just to recap how this all worked out for Denver. So they traded with the Steelers. They had the 10th pick, right? So the Steelers come up for 10th to get Devin Bush. They go down to 20. They take Noah Fant. So we're thinking like, oh, wow. Okay, so that's for Joe Flacco. We know he loves his tight ends. They're not taking a quarterback. So then they take Dalton Reisner, who you love. We'll talk about that in a second, at 41. And then they trade up to the 42. Remember, this was all happening. We're like, what is going on? They're picking back to back. So then they trade up with the Bengals to 42 to grab Luck. I'm just going to say this. The fact that John Elway didn't love Drew Lock to the point where he was willing to take him earlier makes me like Drew Lock more.
Probably a good call at this point, right? Again, given the track record of a guy, it's like, all right, I wasn't willing to. And Drew Lock was the guy. Like, that was the guy that we had heard coming off the Senior Bowl that Elway really liked, right? So we were all worried, my God, is he going to reach in the first round and potentially take this guy who, yes, while he's got a bunch of pretty impressive physical skills and his junior year of college had top-end production that was tied for the best in the NCAA as far as touchdowns passed for, it still kind of scared the hell out of us then, and where they end up getting him at 42 overall ends up being an insane value pick. So I'm with you, absolutely.
Do you think Drew Lock will see the field this season? And if so, how early?
I think he will see, if there's 16 games, I think Drew Lock, I don't think he starts double digit games, but I could see him starting 7 or 8 games this season. And that could be production or, unfortunately, and I don't like saying this because it assumes that I believe this will happen or want it to happen, which is couldn't be further from the truth, but I cannot trust Joe Flacco to be healthy for an entire season at this point, based on the track record of the last few years. I just think we're at that point now where that's not a given and where the physical toll on his body has started to add up in that way, where I could see him being injured kind of like last year, and then all of a sudden the Drew Lock era begins a little earlier than expected.
Yeah, I think that's a likely outcome. I think what's more interesting and contentious is sort of the notion that if Joe Flacco plays like he did at the beginning of last season, which is to say, you know, or maybe a little bit better. Maybe he's like the 23rd best quarterback in the NFL. Statistically, he was below that. What does Denver do? You know, because the calls are going to be loud to bring in Lock, especially if he's good in preseason. And that's a very difficult decision, I think, for that franchise. I'm not sure it's the best. Well, I guess, yeah, it's hard for me to know what the right move there would be, because it would depend on kind of where it is in the season, how far along they are, how the rest of the team looks, and I guess what they see out of Lock early on. you know, I thought he was definitely a guy. He's a developmental guy. You know, he's a high upside quarterback with an incredible arm, who has struggled at times with processing and very, very athletic. And I don't know if it would be best for him to be kind of thrust into the fire like that.
Yeah, it's going to be tough because the problem is the offense he came from in Missouri was, especially before Derek Dooley got there in his last season, for the years prior to that, it was remedial. And, you know, we talked to Dan Orlovsky, who's obviously one of our great college and NFL analysts here, but also a former quarterback, and he saw the same things we did, which is it was kind of a numbers game for a while. Like, you were just basically asked to do basic math as a quarterback and look at the box, and if there was too many people, you'd throw it to the outside and let an athletic receiver make plays. And 1 year kind of trying to remedy that after all of that programming becomes tough, and so you're still kind of have to going to go in and I think break some bad habits when you get to the NFL.
So one more quarterback I want to talk about before we get to mailbag is really, I don't want to say the steal of the draft because I don't think that's quite it, but Miami gives up the 62nd pick for Josh Rosen. And because Arizona, there's a bunch of trades. It's kind of complicated. The Dolphins traded down with New Orleans. So they gave the Saints the 48th and the 116th pick. And then they get back 62, 202, and a 2020 second round, which is nice. And then they send the 62nd pick and a fifth rounder to Arizona. So in aggregate, they gave up 48, 116, and this 2020 late round pick for Rosen and a second rounder and 202. So sorry. That probably added no value to anyone's life, and I'm sorry for spending time talking about that. But what's really nice is because Arizona had to eat a lot of dead money on Rosen's signing bonus, here's how much the Dolphins are paying for him over the next three seasons. $1.3 million, $2.1 million, $2.9 million. That's a cheap backup, Mike. Oh. But they don't just have a backup. They have a guy with, like, incredible upside. I mean, if you're a Miami fan, like, how do you feel today?
I mean, as good as you felt in a long time, Miami's existed in this sort of purgatory for a while, right? Like, yeah. I mean, their quarterback situation there has been so up in the air just because of all the injury that's been a part of that spot. We had the Jay Cutler experience because of that, which, as a very Cavalieri fan, I'm extremely thankful for because it kept Jay out of the booth and got him into the world of reality television. But if you're looking at it from the Ryan Tannehill prism, with that, when Adam Gase was there, you never really got an accurate sense of who he was. And since then, they obviously decided to move on. But you've at least, and I know you've been kind of the leading the charge on this as a fan of the fish tank model this offseason, Mina, but it seems like you've had a plan in Miami, and this adjustment is just that. It's a solid adjustment based on a really low risk for all the reasons you just mentioned.
So I'm glad you brought up fish tank because some of my fellow fish tankers, I think, are a little bit concerned. Well, what if Josh Rosen comes around and messes around and wins a few games? And I think there's a few ways this could check out. One is he comes in and he sucks, and then you're cool. You can keep your tanking. You took a flyer on this guy. Maybe he's going to be your backup for years or whatever. The other outcome is he comes in, he's really good, and you've got the guy, and you're paying him nothing, and that's awesome. The other outcome, and this is the one I think people are worried about, is he comes in, and he's okay, and they win, like, 7 or 8 games, and then it's like, well, what if we jeopardized Fish Tank, and, you know, we got this guy, and we don't really know what we have in him, and he's not that great. I still think if that happens, Mike, they can go up and grab Tua. I mean, it's going to take... Potentially, it could take some trades. They might have to give up some extra draft capital. But my feeling is the potential benefit, the upside of the Josh Rosen pick makes that cost worth it.
I would absolutely agree. I just think because of the financials you just mentioned, what you ended up giving up for, it was so hard to pass up for a guy that most people, when they tell you and are honest, despite how much the Cardinals struggled last year, you would pop out the tape and see exactly what you saw at UCLA that got him drafted in the first round, which is a guy succeeding in spite of what's around him more often than not. A guy despite the fact that he wasn't protected at either level, and a guy despite the fact that all he had swirling around him. I mean, think about this. At UCLA, he had a different offensive coordinator every year for 3 years, and then he gets to the NFL, and Mike McCoy gets fired midway through the season as the offensive coordinator there, and Byron Leftwich takes over. So he is on his fifth offensive coordinator in 4 years. That's insane. Very few people, if any, are going to succeed in those circumstances. So now you come here and you at least get the benefit of, all right, well, there'll be some stability, and this is still a guy we believe can play great football. He's just never really been put in position to do so.
And, you know, he doesn't walk into the best situation,
that's
perhaps.
My fear.
But, yeah, so that's the only other thing is, like, are we going to be able to accurately judge him? There's some pros and cons to this. I actually think, like, Albert Wilson's awesome. You know, the speedster receiver they got out of Kansas City. Devontae Parker, hopefully they'll be able to, now that Gase is out, they'll get him back in the mix. Still like Kenny Stills. The line should be better. They struggled last year. They took the Wisconsin guard you love, Michael Dieter.
Oh yeah, Michael Dieter, Big Ten offensive lineman of the year in 2018.
And they've committed to this coaching staff with Chad O'Shea, the Patriots wide receiver coach. So there's some positives, but it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be pretty. So it's not like he's walking into, you know, Philadelphia or something where you'll be able to tell immediately whether he's the guy. So hopefully there's patience in all things fish tank related. Speaking of patience, before we get to the mailbag, I want to talk about Mother's Day. So growing up, I'm sure everybody did what I did on Mother's Day, which was panic at the last second because you forgot to buy a gift and put together a book of coupons, like free hug, free kiss, stuff your mom never used. Have you ever done the coupon thing, Mike?
I have not done the coupon thing. No, my only Mother's Day experience was giving my mom with my dad and brother a massage chair that she rejected because she knew we bought it just for our own use.
The Homer Simpson bowling ball strategy.
Classic.
Well, look, don't be that guy. Don't do a coupon book, especially if you're an adult. And listen, this Mother's Day, don't settle for anything less than the biggest and brightest bouquets from 1-800-Flowers.com. 1-800-Flowers has amazing offers on beautiful Mother's Day bouquets and arrangements starting at $29.99. With an amazing selection of sweets, treats, and bouquets, 1-800-Flowers has everything you need for Mother's Day, and she will never guess how great of a last-minute deal you scored, unless she listens to this podcast. Like, my mom listens to the podcast. So if I got her, she would know. But she'd be happy because she's Korean and she loves bargains. Mother's Day bouquets and arrangements starting at $29.99 is an amazing offer, but you got to order today. Make sure you lock in this offer. It's only good while supplies last. After you've chosen your gorgeous bouquet arrangement, simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. Trust 1-800-Flowers to make mom feel loved. Order today from 1-800-Flowers.com. To order beautiful and vibrant Mother's Day bouquets starting at $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, it's at the very top of the page, easy to find, and enter code MINA. Order today and save at 1-800-Flowers.com, code M-I-N-A. And with that, let's take some questions.
Question. Question. Lenny, for your thoughts.
So as always, guys, if you leave a positive 5 stars only review in iTunes with a question, we'll get to it at some point. I promise. We're catching up. We're getting closer. And we're starting with a question from MajPies45, who asks me, what was your favorite and least favorite subject in school? Favorite was gym. Just kidding. That's obviously not true. It was English. Least favorite, I always struggled with math and science. What about you, Mike?
I would actually go an outlier. It's a co-tie. I took an American short story class that I really liked in college, and I also really liked physics, oddly. I had a great physics teacher in high school. I once had to do an equation to learn just where a ball would fall off a table when you rolled it at a certain speed, and I accurately did it, and it's the most accomplished I've ever felt in my life.
You know what? I'm going to throw another one. I really liked art in school. Art was really fun. McGilliman. This is dated, but actually it's relevant. Asks, how would you address the running back situation in Philly? Well, McGilliman, Philadelphia did address it. In addition to adding Jordan Howard, who, you know, we had some questions about sort of because of his decline in production. With the 53rd pick, they grabbed Miles Sanders, a.k.a. Saquon Barkley's backup. It was a little rich value-wise, but to me, I'll just say Miles Sanders, I thought, was the... I love Daryl Henderson, and we'll talk about him a little bit later. But I thought Miles Sanders was the second kind of all-around back behind Josh Jacobs. So given that I figured Philadelphia would be looking for kind of an every-down guy, this made a ton of sense to me. And you can also catch passes really well.
It's a great question from Dr. McGillicuddy.
Did you like Miles Sanders? I did like
Miles Sanders, and I said for him because, you know, there were a couple of draft-eligible linemen on the Penn State offensive line, so clearly my whole world begins, ends, and revolves around watching and scouting the position of offensive line. You saw, and it was kind of exactly what Saquon had to deal with, which is not always the best blocking and not always a ton of holes, and yet Sanders still found a way to be really productive. So kind of a Saquon light.
Does have a small fumbling issue, so we'll see. He had 5 fumbles. I wrote that down earlier in my notes and I just found it. Loya, I didn't have it memorized, that's my way of telling you that. Loya8915 asks, what is a realistic contract for Dak Prescott? Hoo boy. That's a long conversation. This is just try to deal with this quickly because, man, there's a lot of things that could shake out before then. I don't think Dak is going to force the issue, Mike, on a Russell Wilson style top of the market contract. Maybe I'm wrong. Optimally, I think for Dallas, they would get more of like a Jimmy Garoppolo, you can get out of it a little easier situation. But you never know. I mean, you just never know how these guys value themselves and their sort of tactics. I think from a value perspective, that's what he should get. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you should. I think you could see it be one of those. I don't think numbers-wise it's going to be anywhere near the top. Well, I shouldn't say that. It'll be close because Jerry Jones is kind of insane and operates under his own code. But
said he was going to make him with the highest pay.
I mean, just come out great negotiation tactics from Jerry Jones.
Part of the deal.
But no, and the Dallas contracts tend to be a little longer when you look at a couple of the big money deals they paid out recently to Zach Martin, Tyron Smith. They tend to be a little longer than the normal market deals, and you know, maybe you can bunch some of that guaranteed money near the front in the first 3 years, like you said, so you can get out of it towards the back end if you need to, and it probably go from there. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw it maybe a little longer, but also for hopefully less money than the Russell Wilsons and Aaron Rodgers of the world, because I want to believe that justice still exists.
Golfy McGolface, great name, asks, what hockey position would you play? I don't know. I don't watch enough. You tell me, Mike. You watch hockey, right?
No, but I appreciate you assuming that because I'm white, I do. So I thank you for that. But, no, I don't watch a ton of
hockey.
I can imagine you being an enforcer though, Mina. Like,
that's the only thing I know.
Yeah, that's the only thing I know too, which is why I said it.
JB Lewis, this is a question for Lenny. What is your favorite place to nap? Well, JB Lewis, Lenny is napping right next to me on one of his favorite beds. He has a dog bed in every room of the house. This is his favorite one because it's like a giant furry cushion and he likes there. Sometimes he'll nap on my lap, which is, Lenny's like just big enough to where that becomes painful after an hour for me. The other place I would say, and maybe this is the right answer, is like a patch of sun on a wood floor.
Ooh,
is,
yeah.
He will, which isn't the softest, but he likes the heat on his bod. So that's Lenny's answer. He's napping, so I had to answer on his behalf. So before we get back to the draft, I want to talk about hiring. Well, I guess that's kind of relevant to the draft because, you know, they're really hiring a bunch of people and they're going to make some bad decisions. They would probably make better decisions if they went to, you guessed it, ZipRecruiter. It's the one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, smart, place where growing businesses like the Raiders connect to qualified candidates. ZipRecruiter.com/Mina. Is the address. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate to your site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Mina. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MINA. ZipRecruiter.com/Mina. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I just want to point out that unlike some people on the Levitard show who constantly giving me crap for being bad at radio, I do my ads in one take. That was one take. So just want you to know.
Can confirm. You are not a victim of the chair.
It's the stuff you don't see behind the scenes, really. So speaking of behind the scenes, no, that doesn't work. Gosh darn it. I'm always trying to think of a good segue, but that didn't really make
sense. I'll leave this part in. What do you think?
Yeah, you can leave it in. It's fine.
I'll take it out.
I'm very transparent. No, leave it in. Leave it in.
Leave it in.
I want people to know that they're getting the full Mina Kimes show featuring Lenny.
It's a real podcast.
I want to talk about draft winners, but, you know, not just like who gets an A, you know, type thing. Because sometimes it's not about the draft necessarily, just the picks, or it's about the people. It's about trades and that kind of thing. So I came up with some winners. I think you've got some too. I'm going to go first with a team, and this is sort of taking a holistic view of things. I just don't see how you can leave out the Cleveland Browns, because who do they take with their first overall pick this year?
The Cleveland Browns?
Odell Beckham Jr. I got you, man.
Odell Beckham. I'm counting Odell Beckham Jr. You know, we talked about that trade. It was a. It's okay, Mike. It's easy to forget.
Man, I'm not going to lie. I'm looking down.
It was a trick question.
Like, man, I'm definitely the lowest IQ that's been on this podcast in quite a while.
Keep this part in, too.
No, leave this part in. I want them to know who I am in the light, all right?
You know, we've talked about that trade a lot, what a heist it was. So they get Odell, and the Giants turned that into – they got Jabril Peppers, but then they turned that into Dexter Lawrence and O'Shane Shimmies. I thought I learned how to say his name this weekend.
O'Shane
Shimmies. Who do you guys like? O'Shane Shimmies. Who do you guys like? But, like, come on. We know how that shook out. And then with the second pick overall, they get another heist, and this is 46. They get Greedy Williams, okay, who – mysteriously fell down draft boards for reasons that I've heard like a zillion theories, from medical obscure and confusing medical stuff to, I don't know, look the wrong way at someone's cat. Who the F knows? But we know he's fast. He's aggressive. He can play man. Dominique thought he was the best cornerback in the draft. So it was an area of need for them. So just the fact that they got. Yeah, they took a kicker in the fifth round. But the fact that they got Odell and Greedy, and I like the Mac Wilson pick in the fifth round, too, in terms of upside. So, to me, they're one of the winners from the weekend.
Yeah, I'd absolutely co-sign that. And I think Sheldon or Greedy Williams and kind of fell into that vein of, yeah, we hear all those things, and we hear, you know, the stuff about him not being a guy that's interested in tackling at all, which I'm glad Dominique pointed out, like, what corner is? Like, I don't know why we end up pretending to care about that kind of stuff when draft time comes around. If you can roll the ball out and Greedy Williams goes and locks down one of the team's best players, then who really gives a damn if he wants to go there and tackle? I don't care if he wants to tackle ever.
So who's your pick?
My pick, I would say Jacksonville. I know, obviously, their whole season is going to be predicated on what the Nick Foles signing ends up being, and I know both of us kind of think that that was a bit of a hefty price tag for Nick Foles, considering the market for a lot of that, but if you've invested on that and it pays off, it allowed you to not reach on a quarterback in this draft and take Josh Allen when he fell to you at number 7 overall, which was a top 3 prospect by anyone's imagination in this draft, and a guy that, because of how good the rest of that defense is going to get single blocked a lot. And for a guy that,
yes,
the career trajectory for Josh Allen's been fascinating to watch, because he was not dominant his entire time in college. He came to college basically a 0-star recruit and a former high school wide receiver, and packed on weight and got more confidence, and the production boom in his last year, going from, I think, 7 sacks each of the years prior to 17.5 or whatever, yeah, the hell it was his senior year, is insane. And it's about the ceiling for him, and his ceiling's going to be allowed to be even higher because he's going to be put in optimal situations there. Juwan Taylor, who we mentioned, kind of like Greedy Williams, fell inexplicably to the 35th overall pick. A lot of talk about a knee injury for him, but also, you know, commitment to football kind of stuff. His weight fluctuated a lot when he was at Florida, all those kind of things. But they get him. They get the one that was interesting to both of us because of Leonard Fournette and his injury history, and obviously some of the very public personality disagreements with Tom Coughlin, was Raquel Armstead out of Temple in the fifth round, a guy who is a runner kind of in the same vein, a, you know, big downhill runner, one-cut guy in an offense that loves to run the ball as often as they do. Thought it was interesting considering. And then a nice late-round flyer in Gardner Minshew, who is, if nothing else, fascinating to me because of his fantastic mustache and his proximity to Mike Leach. But, you know, in an era where we're seeing more air raid quarterbacks get a chance, he's a 6'1 kid, so he's small, but you're right, could develop into a pretty solid backup there given the circumstances.
The Josh Allen thing is interesting because I think when he fell to them after the Daniel Jones, we were all like in recovery from the Daniel Jones pick when it happened. And I think we all agreed, and by we, I mean those of us on the show, that probably the Jaguars were targeting Jonah Williams. And then Josh Allen falls into their lap and they just have to take the best player available because he's so talented. Schematically, it's not what I kind of envision as being the perfect fit for him. They do run a 4-3. I saw him more of a 3-4 outside linebacker. But I think because of the nature of the talent they have on the line, you know, Calais Campbell is obviously still there. I think he's sort of replacing Dante Fowler in that scheme, I imagine. I think it'll be smoother than it would have been if he had gone to a 4-3 elsewhere. But it'll be curious. I'm curious to see, you know, if they use him in different ways. We've talked a lot just sort of about how versatile he is. I would say the only knock I have on Jacksonville, Mike, is just I thought they would take more weapons for Foles because that wide receiver group is pretty thin. They did grab a tight end, which is an area of need, in the third round, Josh Oliver out of San Jose State. who's kind of like a possession guy, possession receiver, you know. We'll see. I don't know. I kind of thought that's where they would go, but yeah, I mean, I do like it when teams double down on what they're really good at, and this is a team that's doubling down on defense. It's a team that went a different direction, but I'm going to choose a winner who's a human being, and that's Lamar Jackson. Okay, so going into this draft, I think there were questions about that the Ravens might actually take a quarterback kind of earlier than people thought. There's questions about how strongly they felt about Lamar Jackson. Although there were stories coming out before the draft about, like, oh, the Ravens are so thrilled with Jackson's work and development this offseason, which I think should have tipped us off that they were very committed to him and kind of wanting the world to know. And then they definitely showed the world how committed they were to him. With the 25th pick, they traded down and they get Hollywood Brown, the DeSean Jackson look-alike, act-alike, play-alike, who a lot of people thought was the best wide receiver in the draft, certainly the fastest. And then a few picks later, after Jalen Ferguson, they take Miles Boykin, very different style receiver, super physical guy, super athletic, different skill set. And then after that, they take Justice Hill. Is it Justice Hill?
No, Justice Hill, you're right.
Justice Hill. It's spelled with a C, so could go either way. Who was the fastest back in the draft. So I look at their draft, the early rounds, and I see skill players for Jackson, and I just see speed. They are doubling down on speed, which is when you have a guy in Jackson where the question mark, I think, is accuracy, but he can throw a deep ball. It makes a lot of sense to me that they chose guys who can separate for him.
Absolutely. And Miles Boykin is a guy that obviously a Notre Dame guy. So my homer showed a little bit, but when you talk about, all right, we know what Marquise Brown is. He's a guy that absolutely lifts the lid off. What Miles Boykin is a guy who's going to catch everything. Monster catch radius.
Yeah.
If it weren't for DK Metcalf, he would have been the story as far as test phenom from the combine, and he matched it with a ton of production. He was a great back shoulder guy with Ian Book at Notre Dame in college. So between that, even a little added protection and insurance along the interior with Ben Powers, one of the Oklahoma offensive linemen. You're right. You pair that all with Mark Ingram, who is a great tone setter. We know is an unbelievable locker room guy, and I think we'll kind of help fill some of the leadership void left behind as Terrell Suggs and Eric Weddle and a lot of the names that we have been used to in the past depart, and you get a new look Ravens team. It's nice to see a young quarterback who, you know, Lamar Jackson was picked at the end of the first round, so it wasn't like one of these guys picked in the top six or the top 10 or anything like that, but getting that support saying, all right, we made this change, we're going to see it through and give you every opportunity to succeed.
All right, give me another winner.
My other winner, I went in your vein, kind of sticking with the paradigm because I saw you do it first, and I went winner with a guy who seems to be the unquestioned winner of last year as a person. That'd be Chris Ballard of the Colts.
Oof.
Obviously, one of the better drafts in
recent history.
Two All Pros from the 2018 draft class for them. He follows it up with a draft where you started to see that if nothing else, even without the benefit of, and I get it, no one saw Darius Leonard last year and thought that he would be what he was, which is a first-team All-Pro, a guy inexplicably snubbed from the Pro Bowl, but nonetheless, you know, led the NFL in tackles, was great. Quentin Nelson was a little more obvious, but no one saw any pick like that necessarily. You know, they have a pick not till the second round. They take Rocky Sin, the cornerback out of Temple, and then follow that up. We know we like Paris Campbell at the end of the second round as well with them. Bobby Orici, and a bunch of really solid picks, but the conversation around Chris Ballard still was, well, Chris Ballard, he tends to have an eye for this stuff, and so he's kind of gotten that Patriot-esque glow where, because he drafted with such Midas touch in the last year, we're kind of starting to already give him the benefit of the doubt on decision-making in an offseason where we were surprised by the fact that with the amount of cap space they had, they didn't go out and spend on more weapons for Andrew Luck. And still, we look at him and we say, all right, well, in Chris Ballard, we trust. And I think getting to that point already for a guy who's on one of the teams we expect to challenge for the AFC title this year is got to be an encouraging sign for them.
I love this draft. I love how committed they are to their cultural approach towards things. It's conservative. They're going to build from the inside. You know, they are not going to overspend and splurge in free agency. Rockison at 34 is tremendous value. A lot of people thought he was a first round cornerback. And then Paris Campbell at Ohio State, probably my biggest wide receiver draft crush. So perfect for Frank Reich's offense, right? Which has moved away. It's become more of a quick strike offense for Andrew Luck. Get the ball out quickly. Obviously, it's assisted by that offensive line, but there's pretty much no better wide receiver for that than getting the ball quickly than Paris Campbell, who can take a 5-yard slant and turn it into 25, like, bam. They also today, by the way, speaking of the Colts, they signed Spencer Ware, the running back for Chief, which is just like, again, that's just smart football, man. Like, don't overdraft a running back. I know we talked about Miles Sanders earlier, but go out and pay a guy who, you know, who not a lot of money. I'm sure it's nothing. And yeah, I love most of the things that they've done there.
I mean, remember Frank Wright too. You talked about getting stronger the way Jacksonville does at a position of strength. Indianapolis really liked their production at running back last year, and Frank Wright comes from a place in Philadelphia where they had no problem using multiples at that position and shuffling guys in and out, and especially when you've got the benefit of an offensive line full of fully grown men with bad intentions, it ends up being a pretty solid recipe to continue to take hits off Andrew Luck like they did finally.
Yeah, Marlon Mack was good. It's great. Everyone was just like, oh, they're going to sign Le'Veon Bell. They don't have a running back. And I was like, wait, well, Marlon Mack had a lot of yards after contact. Like, he's a good back. Maybe he's not like a top 10 running back, but he provides them very competent play at the position. All right, my last winner, and before we get to the perplexing choices, this is going to be shocking to you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The Patriots had a good draft.
No way. I shocked. Everyone sitting around during the draft had to just be like, damn it, how do they keep doing this?
They get N'Keal Harry, wide receiver, which is a position we thought they would target. And, you know, what I said earlier about like Lamar Jackson, how you want guys who can separate and he's got the arm to, you know, hit them downfield. Well, when you have a quarterback who's accurate as Tom Brady, you can get a guy who can't separate. That was the knock on N'Keal Harry. Super powerful guy, super strong after the catch. Him and Brady are just going to wreck the league, I think, or certainly have the potential to. And then they get Jawan Williams late in the second round, and then Chase Winovich, who just is the most Patriots player. I mean, it's just like, you know, we were disappointed that Andy Isabella didn't fulfill every stereotype by becoming New England Patriot, but Winovich did the job for us and brought it all the way home.
Yep, he was a nice consolation prize for sure.
All right, I'm tired of being positive. Perplexing choices. So I've got one that I think I'm gonna soften the blow because ultimately I like their draft, but the perplexing choice. So this is like a snake answer. I'm like a politician trying to have it both ways. The first round of the Raiders draft was very perplexing to me. Then it got good. Okay. And when I say it got good, and I'll just talk about the nice part first, you know, they took Trayvon Mullen from Clemson, who just shredded in the championship, right? And you remember, and to get him at 40, I think, and fulfill a need for them was a great choice. The third round, they got Antonio Brown. I'm including that holistically. So, you know, I like some of the decisions that they made. Oh, and then Isaiah Johnson out of Houston, another cornerback I liked, very late, fourth round. So, very nice. But early on, they take Clelin Ferrell at the fourth pick. That was really a shock, and I think it was forgotten amidst the Daniel Jones furor. But I didn't see a single board. There probably is one, so don't send it to me, but whatever. I didn't see a single board that had him there, and I think everybody was shocked that they took him over Allen. Josh Jacobs at 24 seemed like a reach, even though I thought he would end up a Raider. And I like Jonathan Abram at 27. I really do. But it kind of felt like they were going for a lot of what perhaps they perceived to be safe picks instead of going for upside, which, given where they are in their franchise, seemed to be the move.
Yeah, that was the perplexing part to me, is we went into this draft and we talked a lot about on the show teams that could potentially throw everything into a wrinkle, and we thought it was going to be Washington and we thought it was going to be the Raiders, and it turns out both of those teams kind of stood pat. Washington, one of the better drafts that we saw out of most teams, just based on their ability to be patient. And the Raiders, instead of packaging pick, you know, moving back and picking up a ton of capital for any of those first rounders or swinging wildly on anything, kind of went with pedigree and kind of went for guys that were from proven programs and proven situations in a way that, I don't know, I kind of kept looking up and going, well, yeah, like, I really like Clelin Ferrell. Like, I think he's going to be a really good player, but at four overall, when you're usually seeing people draft for upside, it was just shocking, especially given the parts involved and how volatile it all seemed.
You know, which is interesting because last year they made some risky choices that paid off. Mo Hurst, arguably, yes. I mean, we'll see how that shakes out. So it was interesting. This feels like Mayock really having his influence. I mean, who knows? But I don't know. I guess I like Ferrell a lot, but he's a high floor, lower ceiling guy, right? And I think he'll probably start day one, but I don't know. Josh Allen just seems to have more potential. So who's a perplexing choice for you, or what's a perplexing choice for you, rather?
Perplexing choice for me, and you know what? It's probably good that you didn't say losers in this, because I don't really see it as a negative as much as I see it as a little bit just what you said, perplexing. The Carolina Panthers draft is interesting to me, and a lot of it centers around the Will Greer pick in the third round. And I understand we're in a time period where we spend a lot of capital, whether it's financial or draft-wise, on a competent backup, on the idea of building a backup in that situation. We've seen teams pay for it and everything else. But in the last couple of years, when we've seen them try and load up, you know, bring in the Christian McCaffreys of the world and these other short area weapons around Cam Newton, you'd figure that would have been a little bit more priority. And honestly, on defense, you know, moving on from Thomas Davis in a way they finally have in the last few seasons, who, as he got old and injured and had to do certain things there, Luke Kuechly, you can't have any guarantees of anymore. The foundation of your defense has looked different. And Brian Burns is their first round pick, is a guy I really like as a mover, but a guy who, I don't know, instant impact right away. I'm going to be very interested to see, because for all the physical gifts, he played on a Florida State team that obviously struggled, a defense that was still productive. But every time on the turn on the tape, I expected more from him, and I didn't feel like I always got it. So you combine that with Greg Little in the second round, who is a great pass protector, no doubt about it, and protecting Cam Newton has been woefully down on the list of things up there. I don't know, maybe it's the lack of addressing a ton of needs on defense. You know, they took Christian Miller out of Alabama in the fourth round, but spending that third round pick on a quarterback when I felt like defense could have been a place where maybe you were a little better served is the only reason I've got some reservations about this. So perplexed seems to be the right word.
I agree with you there. I do like the Brian Burns pick, I think, a little bit more than you, but I too thought that they would invest more in the defense, perhaps in the secondary. And Will Greer, to me, it kind of felt like an unnecessary reach. Just because I like him, but they don't really need to take a flyer on a quarterback, like a potentially high upside quarterback. You know what I mean? Like, I guess the idea is, well, Cam gets injured a lot, so we want a guy who can come in. I don't know if Will Greer is that guy necessarily. And provide steady quarterback play. So as much as I actually do think he has a lot of potential, it felt like a reach for me. So I'm with you there. I'm going to take a team. My next perplexing choice is a team that I felt like had a very glaring area of need and didn't sufficiently address it. And, that's the Houston Texans. Basically, they just got screwed. So they were at 23, I want to say. Yeah, 23. And as the draft was shaking out, you knew what they wanted to do, which was to take Andre Dillard. Then boom. Howie Roseman trades up, grabs Andre Dillard at 22, and I cannot imagine what the mood was like in the Houston war room when that happened. And I'm speculating here. Who knows? I don't actually know for a fact that they wanted Andre Dillard necessarily, but given the fact that with the next pick they took Titus Howard, the former quarterback, high school quarterback turned, which is great, turned, and I'm sure we'll hear about it a lot if he starts, turned tackle, offensive tackle, which is... it's been such a sore area of need for Houston. It just feels like they had to settle for a player who should not have been drafted at that position.
Yeah, and I think you combine that with a couple of things, right? Like, we went into this knowing, like you said, that offensive line was such an area for need for them. And the two guys they take high in this draft are Titus Howard, as you mentioned, and Max Sharping out of Northern Illinois, who, again, is another guy that looks like he could be something, but in an NFL where nowadays – I don't know, the development timeline, especially at offensive line, has really shortened based on how long coaches get to produce. And I get Bill O'Brien doesn't seem like a guy that might be going anywhere right now based on the offensive success this team has managed to have. But, like, offensive linemen just don't develop quite as well anymore. There are a lot fewer good coaches. You've got so much less time. I know this is kind of a broken record that you've heard from me time and time again, but it's like, man, you need to protect Deshaun Watson now. And that offensive line was awful last year, and I don't
couldn't
feel
get
like
on a plane. He couldn't get on a plane. I'm sorry. I know we keep repeating that, but it's so unacceptable when your quarterback literally cannot get on a plane. And to what you're speaking to, I think that's why Dillard, people wanted him so much, was because he was probably, I don't want to say the most polished tackle. Obviously, Jonah Williams is there, but certainly in that conversation.
No, it really was. And I guess that's the perplexing part is you needed finished products in the Houston more than you needed most things and you needed on the offensive line. And you took two guys pretty far apart where there were plenty of other prospects that were probably cleaner, that came from more reputable programs, that could have provided you with a more ready-made guy right away. And you instead went for the guys that are going to require a little bit of development. And I didn't think that's what you needed. You needed plug-and-play guys that were going to give you either a chance to be a starter or a competent backup right now in order to make sure that your quarterback could actually ride the plane this year.
So I'm just going to burn quickly through my perplexing choices and let me know if you have any left. I thought the Falcons choices early on, taking the two offensive linemen, were a little weird. Chris Lindstrom, I know you liked, but center? Really? Okay. And then Caleb McGarry, the tackle out of Washington, was kind of a meh for me. And you know, given that that was a position they did invest a fair amount in free agency and in some of their needs on defense, I was kind of like, really? Okay. I thought Dallas would take a safety. I didn't quite get their first three picks. Tristan Hill, high upside tackle, defensive tackle out of Central Florida.
Absolutely.
Guard. Yeah.
Absolutely. Guy who, a lot of production, always jumped on tape. Yeah, exactly. Boom or bust. A lot of questions at UCF of, given all the talent you saw when he was on the field, why wasn't he on the field more? Was it, there's something we were missing? Was it conditioning? What was it? A lot of people had questions about that.
And then they took in their fourth pick, they took a running back. The guy behind Daryl Henderson, Tony Pollard. He's a kick returner as well. And the last one I'll do before you tell me if you have any left is the Packers draft was a little bit weird to me. Taking Gary, I thought at 12 was a stretch. We've talked a lot about him and his lack of production. You know, he's again another boomer bust guy. And then they took a safety with their next pick in the first round, Darnell Savage. I thought they would grab a weapon for Rodgers. They did take a tight end, Jay Sternberger later, but I don't know. I just think that was something they should have hit in this draft and they didn't.
Yeah, and considering what a priority defense was in free agency, you felt like they had addressed that to a point that was, you don't want to say serviceable, but where you can look up and in the grand scheme of things in Green Bay, you really, at this point, it's kind of, all right, how can we continue to show Aaron Rodgers that as we've invested in him, we're also doing that finally from our personnel moves in a way that we didn't for the vast majority of his career. And I felt like you had checked a lot of those boxes with the guys that you had signed in free agency this offseason. And you're right, could have given him something in the way of another competent weapon to go outside there. So, yeah, I would agree with you on all of those choices as far as perplexing moves of the draft. Because overall, there were a lot of really good moves that we liked, but these teams definitely stuck out.
So before we get to Dinks and Ducks, I want to tell you about Tissot, the official watch of the NBA. Whenever a guy's wearing a watch, well, ladies too, what I always think is that person really has their life together if they're wearing a watch. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's just what I think. I'm just telling you the truth. Each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. The graduation season is coming up, so you can get the NBA Fan Your Life a Tissot watch for that. The Tissot Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. Shop now at us.tissotshop.com. And now for the last segment.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
All right, Mike. So we've established that you've watched Avengers. I have not. So without spoiling it, just tell me, who's your favorite character?
My favorite character in Avengers, all time or in the final movie overall?
In the final movie.
In the final movie, my favorite character is probably Thor. And it would seem like it's for a lot of obvious reasons, the things that I would admire about Thor. But this last movie, there is an added wrinkle to it. Again, no spoilers, but you're getting, I think, the best version of Thor we've gotten in a while.
What are the obvious reasons? Is it just that he's a big white man?
Yeah, big, jacked, good looking. I mean, listen, I'm like everybody else. Like, obviously, you know, women have been objectified for years, but I enjoy turning the tables and objectifying men. And Chris Hemsworth is very easy to objectify given the way he looks and his physical attributes. So I enjoy doing that from time to time.
And I meant a big white man because I thought perhaps you were making an association. Oh, you felt like you would be Thor.
No. I am confident in vain. I am not that confident in vain.
Question two. This is just a conversation I was having with a couple of friends last night. Who is the most handsome NBA player?
Ooh, the most handsome NBA player. I'm trying to think. Who are some names that were in the running of people you had
a conversation
with?
Yeah, I'll throw you up. Yeah. So here's you. Okay, we're watching Jimmy Butler. That got thrown out. Al Horford.
What?
Paul George. Kevin Love. You're hating these choices.
I you know what? Like, I understand, like, they've got certain features, but, like, top to bottom, I don't really consider a lot of those guys overwhelmingly handsome. And now, again, I feel like a dick because you said Kevin Love, and I lit up, and he's the only white guy you've mentioned so far. So now that's become
Al
problematic.
Alford's eyes are so beautiful.
You know what? And, like, I probably need to give him more credit because, I don't know, Al Horford was a guy that I mocked.
Right.
I mocked a lot around the NBA All-Star game last year because I said when they were doing the draft that he would have been the last pick, and then he went out after that and has been on an absolute tear ever since, rubbing it into my face, so.
That's what he does.
Yeah, I give Kevin Love credit for the glow-up, too. Like, what Kevin Love has been able to do
incredible.
In spite of where he came from, I think deserves a lot of credit and maybe gives him a leg up in a lot of this. Like, I'm trying to think.
Dame?
You know what I actually think? I think Dame Lillard is a pretty good-looking guy, actually. I would be willing to co-side Dame in a lot of that one. I like Ricky Rubio's hair, too. There's something about long-haired Ricky Rubio now. It's so different from the guy. Kyrie Irving's a pretty good-looking dude, too, I think.
All right. I don't agree with those. But who's your favorite sneaky fit in the draft? So my not a first-round guy, but a guy you're like, wow, that combination of player and team. Mine, I kind of alluded to earlier, I love Daryl Henderson on the Rams in that offense. So who's a guy that you would pick?
Sneaky fit in this draft. I would go.
And
I will buck the trend of offensive line, even though, as I mentioned, I think Lamont Gilyard going to the Cardinals is an absolute steal and a half for them. I would also go, we talked about Chase Winovich as the quintessential Patriots pick. Damian Harris out of Alabama, the running back there. In a backfield that had Josh Jacobs, we know was one of the top picks by the Oakland Raiders. Damian Harris was never really the featured or the best or most talented guy in the Alabama backfield, but I believe he rushed for 1,000 yards in 3 straight years. He was unbelievably productive, even given the limited touches. He's a willing pass protector, even being a smaller guy. And we know the way the Patriots use running backs. They're going to maximize all the things you do well and basically use you in those specific areas. I think he's a really great pick for them and a guy that's going to be productive in special teams. He had a game against Florida State 2 years ago where he had like 90 yards rushing and blocked a punt in the same game. So he's just a quintessential Patriot running back, and I think it's a really interesting fit and steal for them.
Question 4. So I bragged to you. Well, it wasn't like a brag. I was very confused why Chipper Jones, baseball player, followed me on Twitter. It's like sometimes, you know, when someone follows you, you're just confused. You're like, why do you follow me? What are you getting out of this? Because we don't have a lot in common. And it's just kind of perplexing, and you almost want to ask them. And then last night, he liked one of my jokes, so I can only assume he just likes my sense of humor. This was a long-winded brag way of asking, what's a celebrity Twitter follower you would want?
Ooh, I would. Well, you know what? I will go from would want to. I actually had the same situation happen to me that you described there happen to me in college. It was really strange. When I was in Notre Dame, I was probably a junior or senior. It was around that whatever year the Steelers played in that Super Bowl where James Harrison had the like 90-yard touchdown return on defense. I forget exactly what Super Bowl that was, but Lamar Woodley was the other outside linebacker on that defense. And I remember out of nowhere, I looked up one day, and I was a Twitter nobody at this point. And Lamar Woodley was following me on Twitter. And it was so perplexing that I actually DM'd him, and I'm like, dude, you know this isn't my dad's account, right? Like, I'm in college.
No, I
did. And I went and shot my shot, and he says, no, I know, I get it. He's like, I've seen you when you've been on the show before, like all that stuff. And then about a week later, he had unfollowed me. So I actually, I unshot my own shot on Lamar Woodley. So
you shouldn't have drawn attention to it.
Oh, it was horrific. It was the most insecure, like, college kid response to that situation possible. I'm ashamed.
Yeah, you gotta play it cool. I imagine this is what it must feel like to be like an attractive person in a crowd at a concert, and the person playing on stage like points at you or something and like signals to go backstage. Maybe that only happens in movies, but
I would know. As soon as you said attractive person, I kind of recused myself from the conversation.
That's what
so
it's like to be followed by Chipper Jones. Well, okay, that story about your dad kind of platforms Lenny's question.
Oh,
I apologize. Yeah, this was his question. Mike, this weekend, Nick Bosa was picked first overall, and the Bosa family became the first ever to have a father and two sons go in the first round of the NFL draft. I don't know if that's actually exactly true, but it feels right. I think I heard it somewhere, probably on your show, which I caught a little bit of, but I was busy. Anyways,
are the Golics the only family of football players ever to achieve fame and renown despite not having achieved serious NFL success?
Wow,
that's a really long question. Wow.
It was both long-winded and cruel from Lenny. I'll give him the slight assist there that the second family, the Mannings, also three first-round picks, father and two sons. In that
oh, wow.
There.
Factually inaccurate, Lenny.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't you choke on that one for a little bit, Lenny, as you nap in one of your many luxurious dog beds. You
he are just
a-
woke up.
I see. He heard me talking shit. That was what happened. But no, you know what's funny is in this vein, you're absolutely right. Like, obviously, Dad came the closest, 9 years in the NFL, nothing to shake a stick at. But my brother and I were abject failures in this regard. And the way that we've kind of referenced it is there was one other family that got close, and that was the Longs. Two first-round picks in Kyle and Chris Long, the sons, but Hall of Famer Howie Long, second-rouner out of Villanova. We are the shitty Longs. Like, in every way, shape, or form, we're the Longs just like the Costco brand version. Like, Chris Long is this very tattooed, great football player, but he's a hot dad who's saving the world with his foundation. He's all the things that I am not.
Perfect.
Kyle is a human grizzly bear. You know, it's Howie Jr. works in the Raiders, similar to the way that my sister, actually the only Golic offspring to make it in the NFL, worked for the Cleveland Browns and for the Chicago Bears in the social media department. So we are in every way, shape, and form the shitty Longs. We are the true, we're the true personification of grit in the world of sports and social media.
I haven't watched Us, but I read the Wikipedia page, and I'm envisioning you guys being tethered to the Longs.
Oh, dear God.
From the underworld, trying to come up, but you're the worst versions of them. That's probably not, that wasn't the point of Us at all, but I just read the Wikipedia, so cut me some slack. Mike, thanks as always for coming on the show. Appreciate you, bud.
Thanks for having me.